Good morning. I commend the organizers of this event, the Philadelphia Society, for daring to deal squarely with a topic as electric as this, and first thing on a Saturday morning. Excuse me for reading, Carol. I'm doing it for you in order to be punctual. Got my words measured, but it reminds me of a bishop that was once asked of a young preacher what he thought of his manuscript preaching. And he said, well, there are only three things wrong with it. One, he read it. Two, he didn't read it well. And three, it wasn't worth reading. So I hope that's not your experience this morning. Thank you, Dr. Ferguson, not only for your words about economic dimensions and for your gentle gardening, but also for your work in St. Louis and throughout the church. Thank you, Dr. Derek Green, for your provocative and evocative proposal for a path of cultural renewal with respect to the plaguing and persistent question of so-called race. Christians and non-Christians, the elect and non-elect alike, and the whole world really could do with a healthy dose of your confidence in the sovereignty of God, that God acts in history, that there are no unsupervised processes in the universe, that God is actually up to something in this space and time, not to mention your deployment of the term covenant as a theological theme that you dare to apply to the American experiment. And I would like to hear more from you about the divine dimensions of our quote-unquote our national covenant and what God has to do specifically with American exceptionalism. I will simply iterate today a series of I would really like to hear more about this comments as a way of responding to Dr. Green's fine work. It's so much easier being a respondent. Like you, Dr. Green, I'm proud of my reformational roots. As you will soon hear, mine have a Lutheran accent to them. Even more, I am certain that we are overdue in these United States for the work that you propose, a constructive and positive American conversation on race, which to be American must include a plurality of perspective, not merely the progressive orthodoxy that ironically, despite claims and calls for openness, as we all know, ends up being censorious and punitive towards any other points of view. What I like least about the prevailing racial essentialist orthodoxy is that it reinforces the victim-focused identities of a resentful class, permanently locked into a paralysis of anger, despair, and incivility. Narrow-mindedness is an intellectual plague, and that's how I begin my endorsement of this volume, yours, in which you have a great essay in, Dr. Green. And a fellow endorser of this prolific volume is the prolific chairman of the Philadelphia Society, Dr. McClay. The title is Race and Covenant. I recommend it. By the way, I agree existentially with the uniqueness of the freedoms proffered here in the United States. I am an immigrant. In fact, I'm a double immigrant. I was born in Jamaica, where it's nice and warm, and my family moved from there to Canada, where it wasn't warm and just a bit too nice for my constitution. So I moved to the United States and found home 40 years ago, and I have not looked back, despite hardship, unequal treatment, injustices, overt exclusion. All of that is a part of every great American story, isn't it? The opportunities outweigh and are worth the challenges. My wife, can you stand for a moment, Monique? You look so good this morning. Can you just stand for the people? Yeah. My wife, born in Selma, Alabama. Her father was a campus pastor at the only Lutheran HBCU, historically black college and university. Her father attended the Colored Seminary of the Lutheran Church in Greensboro, North Carolina. The family settled finally in Chicago at the tail end of the Great Migration. And her mother was a public school teacher, the owner eventually of 9 buildings in Chicago and St. Louis. And this is only in America, because Monique's grandmother and great-grandmother were sharecroppers in Alabama. Papa Henry, her great-grandfather, owed so much money to the property owner because the share of his land, the land he managed, did not produce enough cotton for 2 years consecutively, that his children had to work until retirement age to pay off the debt. Not everything that is legal is ethical, right, good, true, or beautiful. And so I appreciate, Dr. Green, that you did not gloss over or minimize the, quote, legal and moral problems of racial injustice in America. But I also appreciate that you did not capitulate to making the oppressor-oppressed motif as the defining characteristic of our national identity. I do love the way you have shown a positive light. I almost said shone, which is the way Canadians say it. Shone a positive light on the particularity of the sort of pluralism that can happen only in the USA. There's something unique, and I believe God is up to something with respect to our diversity. There, I said it. I'm ending my tenure as a college president in New York. In New York City, there are 800 languages spoken among 20 million people. This is the most diverse megalopolis on the planet by far. Nobody comes close to the degree of diversity and pluralism we have here. And so, yes, the mark of slavery is one that we bear. And unlike the calls of certain theorists that these social structures are beyond redemption and must be burned down in the cause of justice, I thank you, Dr. Green, for articulating a path of redemption towards full human flourishing, because God acts in history. But I would like you to be a little bit more secular about this history in which God acts, because not in every case is it the case that, in your words, quote, secular agendas of justice emotionally manipulate, coerce, and guilt white people into action. First, as you well know, sir, some faith-based sectors, even in the historic Black church, are quite adept at playing the race hustle game. We're not naming names yet. And second, more importantly, God acts within structures that are beyond the church. Ordnung, Luther would call them. Mandatum Dei, Dietrich Bonhoeffer would call them. And in them, racism can be embedded. We must admit that in multiple social structures, racism can be institutionalized. But healing is found in the wound, not in destroying the structure. So as Glenn Lowry points out in this same volume, his point with an economic tilt, quote, citizens of this republic bear a responsibility to be actively engaged in changing the structures that contain the Black poor. But since, like you, Dr. Green and Dr. Lowry, I believe in redemption, I believe that God not only acts in, with, and under the church, but in other structures also, making them habitats of hope. And so we ought to think beyond the church, towards 3 other structures. First, we need to think about the critical institution called the family and marriage, which should be the locus, for example, of social stability, the civilizing function, and the place of advocacy for the rights of the unborn, which is also a racial problematic. Third, we need to be concerned about the workplace and labor and vocation. And I would add education as preparatory of that. The fact that God actually works within these settings and scenarios. God even works in schools of higher education still. although I was at a conference earlier this week representing the Bipartisan Policy Center. Steve, I see you here. And I think Jackie Pfeffer Merrill, she's the director of the project. And we were on a panel discussion, three presidents of color, of African descent, more or less. And we were at one point lectured at by a student affairs advocate who appeared to be white. And we were told about how fatigued people of color are with racial injustice. She informed us of that. And that the burden should not fall on them anymore because they're just victims. And the kind of inferential adjective was hopeless victims, and it falls to us. And so we must change the whole system. Dr. Green would say that the historic black church and HBCUs have not been waiting on systems to provide access or doors to open. They've been knocking down doors through emotional resilience, intellectual toughness, and self-determination. Because from a worldly perspective, success is the best form of revenge against racism. The final structure I want to look at is government and the political realm, and I've left that for last on purpose. Maybe local or mediating structures can make an impact, but we should maybe talk more in the Q&A. Do I ever affirm, Dr. Green, your call for forgiveness as the basis of redemption and restoration? In fact, you cite a scripture, which is the appointed lectionary in most churches for this Sunday, the fourth Sunday in Lent. And because of you, sir, I'll be preaching it tomorrow in Los Angeles. Thank you. Paul addresses here the desperately divided, irrepressibly tribal church at Corinth. And you make well the distinction between forgiveness on the one hand and reconciliation on the other. Thank you for that distinction in your words and work. Forgiveness and reconciliation are two distinct sort of actions, but correlated, and you keep them together. Mrs. Nunes was one day reminding me of how much she had forgiven me. Multiple times she was reiterating how much she had. And so I said something like, baby, I thought you forgave and forgot. And she said, I did forgive and forget. I just don't want you to ever forget that I forgave and forgot. She said it just like that. But she's right. Forgiveness does not mean catching amnesia on the one hand, but neither does it mean, on the other hand, being toxified by remembrance. It means letting go and moving on and transcending tribal identities. And Green seems to be here advocating for the same thing that even Cornel West did some 30 years ago when he said, quote, we need race transcending prophets, and you are one. People who never forget the significance of race, but refuse to be confined by it. I would add defined by it. Finally, you propose that the black church should reestablish the task of reconciliation. Two things I'd like to hear more about with that. When do you surmise historically that it forsook that task, and why? Samuel Proctor, formerly of Abyssinian Baptist Church, suggests that that task was diverted from when the clenched fist of black power was raised and there was no spiritual center remaining on the inside. But I'd like to hear from you on that. And finally, I'd like to hear more from you on, does there remain in our time enough galvanizable currency in the black church? Does it wield enough sufficient community influence yet in our day? Does the growth of non-denominational churches in urban settings, for example, we have T.D. Jakes here at the Potter's House, and although he's an African-American pastor, the church is populated by black, white, Asian, Latinos, and all kinds of people like me of mixed race. And so can we return to a time when that so-called invisible institution was the primary agent of social change? I want to thank you, Derek, for refreshing us today. Those who are in Christ have been given this ministry of reconciliation. They are a new creation. Thanks for telling us what we are. The old has passed away, and behold, the new has come. Thank you.